Welcome to Attack the System Radio, a program dedicated to pan-anarchism against the state and pan-secessionism against the empire, with Keith Preston. Politicians hide themselves away. They only started the war. Why should they go out to fight? They leave their all to the poor. Yeah.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston, coming to you from attackthesystem.com. This is the evening of Sunday, November 24th, 2013, and I have a guest on the program with me this evening, Mr. Todd Lewis, whom some of you may be familiar with by having read some of his articles that were published on attackthesystem.com. In particular, Todd wrote a very comprehensive critique of some of my own writings. And I posted that on Attack the System under the title of Where Keith Preston Falls Short. And I also did an entire podcast at one point where I discussed Todd's original essay, and Todd wrote a response to that as well. So both of those writings are currently available. You can find them in our archives. But I'm going to have Todd on the program to talk some more about these and some other ideas. So welcome to the program, Todd.
Well, thank you for having me, Keith.
All right, Todd, let's start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself. Who are you?
Well, that could be answered in a few ways. I think the most interesting way right now is I am a Christian. I've always been one, but I've, over the past probably 10 years, significantly changed some of my original assumptions about Christianity and politics and economics and all these things. I would say that I'm most similar to the Anabaptist community. They might, not that I'm practicing Amish or anything, but theologically speaking, that would be the most closest living example that your listeners might be familiar with.
What do you
politically? Well, actually, I first heard about Attack the System from, I think it was Alternate Right, some of the articles you wrote there. And I figured out about them a long time ago. I don't remember when or where. But I'm always looking for new, fresh ideas. And they provided some, and you provided some. I was particularly intrigued with your notion of totalitarian humanism, which is not dissimilar from the Mises crowd, and they'll say humanitarianism with a guillotine. But at the moment, I would say that trying to find a political expression of Christianity that's not tied to the typical elite establishment of the Republican Party, or even now the Democratic Party, is probably one of the big things that I'm working on right now.
Well, you mentioned that you identify with the Anabaptist tradition. For listeners who don't know what that is or what the history of that is, could you give a very generalized overview of what the Anabaptist tradition actually is?
Sure. During the 15th, 16th century, there's a lot of questioning of Roman Catholicism, the dogmas of the church, you know, especially after the loss of credibility the Pope suffered during the Babylonian captivity, which is a period of 70 years where the French king kidnapped the Pope, and he just rubber-stamped everything the French king wanted until eventually he was, through negotiations, the Italians in Rome were able to get the Pope to come back. And in Germany and in Northern Europe, a broad base of anti-Catholic sentiment was being built up. Now, with the Reformation, there were two broad branches, the Magisterial Reformation, with Luther, Calvin, and Zwingli, where the church and the state were seen as united together, two sides of the same coin. And a Baptist said, no, we don't go with that. We'll go with the New Testament, over and above the old. The Reformers typically interpreted the New Testament in light of the old, whereas the Anabaptists interpreted the Old Testament in light of the new. So the Sermon on the Mount and Jesus' teachings were more important for daily living than the teachings of Moses, which, while not wholly obsolete, were no longer applicable in certain situations. And they typically tended to have a more, oh, it's anachronistic in terminology, anarchic setup, where you don't seek state sponsorship, you don't seek to kill people to believe a certain way, which is what the Catholics and the Protestants and, to a lesser degree, the Orthodox had done throughout their history. And that's, in a nutshell, the Anabaptists.
Well, one thing that many people are not aware of concerning the Anabaptists is that they were really one of the very first movements in European civilization to advocate for the separation of church and state, meaning to abolish the idea that you don't have to kill people in order to convert them. As they said, virtually all of the other established churches had practiced that, and they were really one of the first to abandon ideas like that, and they suffered a great deal of persecution for that. The Anabaptists were routinely killed by Protestants and by Catholics. Well, what would you consider then to be the essence of the Christian faith? Because clearly there are many different types of Christianity. I mean, there's Christianity, and then there's the three major traditions, and then within those major traditions you have a lot of minor traditions, and most people are aware of that. I've heard that there are 23,000 Protestant denominations.
Yeah.
So what would you consider to be the essence of the Christian faith?
I would say the essence is to be like Jesus. And that means, in a concrete sense, the way Jesus lived and acted, as we read in the Gospels, is the way that we're supposed to live and act. So, did Jesus run for president? Did Jesus create political action groups? Did Jesus go on a jihad? No. That's a very simplistic definition, but you also brought up the idea about religious freedom and the idea that you should respect people's conscience of opinions. And it's interesting because a lot of times you'll see this story told this way. After the wars of religion, people got sick of the religious Catholics, Protestants, killing for certain beliefs. And so either liberal Christians or secular humanists got together, social contract or whatever, and created a sort of non-denominational state that got us beyond killing each other. But the actual foundation for freedom of conscience is in the Christian tradition. In the Apology to the Romans, the church father Tertullian wrote, paraphrasing, that it's the right of every person to have freedom of conscience before God. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy lays out a brief history of it, and it starts with these early Christians writing to the Roman emperors. But when Constantine joins the church and the state, those arguments are seen as less compelling for those who are running the empire. But in the 15th and 16th and 17th centuries in France, when there's the trouble with the Huguenots, a Protestant French group from Navarre, which is in northern Spain, but they had moved into France, how does the empire stay together? And so you had two theorists, Jean Bodin and Pierre Bayle. Bodin was a Jansenist, which was a heretical form of Catholicism, which had a very Calvinistic view of free will that man didn't have any. And then Pierre Bayle, who was a Calvinist. And they both consciously referred back to the early church fathers and their writings on freedom of conscience, and as a way to have, as the state, this kind of arbitrator between these religious disputes.
Well, what other traditions within Christianity would you tend to identify with or admire in some way or consider to have informed your own thinking?
I would say the earliest Christian traditions of the first 3 centuries before the Roman Empire became quote-unquote Christian. The Donatists, the Waldensians during the pre-Reformation period, and certainly the Anabaptists, thinkers like Dorothy Day and Leo Tolstoy, with their arguments for pacifism and community living, were very influential. Some of the monastic orders have, like St. Francis and the Franciscans, at least early on, they tried for a more purist expression of living out Christ before there was a, before the Catholic Church integrated them into their system, and then they bought into the imperial system.
Well, for readers who aren't familiar with figures like Dorothy Day and Tolstoy, could you tell us a little bit about who they were?
Yeah. Tolstoy was a Russian nobleman who, in his early life, was famous for novels like Anna Karenina and War and Peace. He was a larger-than-life figure, very served in the Crimean War, and you name it, he did it. But in his 50s, he had a crisis of faith and identity crisis, and he basically took an extremely radical view of Christianity and Christ as far as living out non-resistance. You know, so his view was that you don't, you know, kill the enemies of Christianity. You show the same love to them that Christ showed to the people that put him on the cross. And he later wrote many more non-fictional works like The Kingdom of Heaven is Within You and What I Believe, where he explains these doctrines that he has. Some of his theological positions are unorthodox, but as far as practical application, he's, I think, pretty spot on. And Dorothy Day, she started out as an anarchist, but because she found this sort of atheist materialism unsatisfying, she joined certain Catholic lay movements, which emphasized local community living. And so she still has a lot of that anarchist organizational mindset, but within the context of the broader Catholic tradition. And they both emphasize a kind of localism, local living, living in charity to the people outside the Christian church, showing them Christ's love rather than destroying them or other things like that.
Well, what Christian churches today or Christian denominations today do you think get it right or come closely to manifesting some of these ideals that you're talking about?
Today, we have in the Western tradition the Mennonites, the Amish, lesser known the Hutterites, the Northwest and Canada, they're mostly up there. Those groups, despite their divisions over, not over serious doctrine, but more cultural differences, they generally accept those principles of community living and living out Christ's life now. And in Russia, there's still the Tolstoyans, followers of Leo Tolstoy. And but there aren't that many right now.
Well, how would you bring these ideas into a political framework? Like, what kind of politics do you think would be shaped by some of these kinds of ideas?
Mm-hmm. So the first thing, I would like to start off with sort of a definition of the state. Now, the state today is often defined as a monopoly on violence from Marx Faber. While there's some utility to it, I think it's oversimplistic. Aristotle in the Politics gives the definition of a state as, he says that man is a social creature, and so there's ever more complicated arrangements of social organization. So individuals form families, families form cities, and then cities form states. And the idea is that families come together to create a political system that will, one, ensure the propagation of the very ideals that the family values, And furthermore, creates the conditions where those ideals can flourish and where the next generation can be educated into those ideals. So I would say that every human community is a state in the Aristotelian sense. And so I would generally agree is a broad definition of a state. That's what the state would be. And so with the Aristotelian definition, I would say that a Christian state would be a body of believers that accept a common creed, a common set of practices, and they would organize themselves on various lines. So there'd be no public state, like a government forcing people to do certain things. It would be more like traditional anarchy, where anarchy is defined as a society in which voluntary action is the basis for social cohesion. And so you'd have a lot of families and churches and voluntary organizations like Salvation Army and Goodwill and things like that, which would create the social space in the community. Because within any political system, there's a fixed amount of political space. It's either the state controls it in the more Weberian sense, or it's organic social institutions like churches, businesses, families, nonprofit organizations, fraternities, whatever. And so in a Christian society, all of those organizations would fill up the political space. The state, in a Weberian sense, wouldn't be there. But in an Aristotelian sense, since the family is the fundamental unit of the state, that would be one of the fundamental elements, as well as with the church, which is also like a family. And like Aristotle's state is not a biological family, necessarily speaking. And so what kind of a foreign policy would such a place have? The foreign policy wouldn't be that of, say, Switzerland, the porcupine, or even, the empire like the United States or the Soviet Union. A way to think about it would be much like the Amish today, a community within a larger community that sort of has its own institutions that it relies on and is opted out of the government welfare system, much of the tax system, the draft, and things like that. And so it's some of the earlier church fathers, like Clement of Rome, termed them as colonies. So you'd see them as little islands or colonies within the larger world. And to the extent that they could opt out of government obligations, that would be required, but you can't always do that because the governments always draw a line in the sand. So yeah, a combination of what you would see the collective living of the Amish without necessarily rejecting technology. It'd be a case-by-case basis where each community would decide, does this technology work for us or does it not? As far as economics, as long as it's voluntary, I wouldn't care if it's a laissez-faire private enterprise, communalism, or a cooperativism like Mondragon or distributism. So it's kind of very eclectic. There's, as long as you follow the basic principle of charity and voluntarism, almost any economic system could work and be accepted within this socio-political economic model.
Well, on the question of foreign policy, if I'm hearing you correctly, it sounds like you're saying that the way to handle that is to simply disengage from the state. And it sounds like you're not really advocating for any kind of foreign policy, not even an isolationist or non-interventionist foreign policy, as much as you're advocating individual and collective refusal to collaborate with the state. In the same sense, for example, that Tolstoy said, well, when the state goes to war, if everyone just refused to go along with that and adopted a completely pacifistic or declared themselves a conscientious objector, war would be impossible. Is that what you're saying?
Sort of. I would first want to make a few comments and then clarify. In Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago, there was a story where a Tolstoyan was arrested by the Bolsheviks, and the Bolsheviks said, if we were all like you, there wouldn't be any whites or reds or civil war. So even the Bolsheviks understood Tolstoy's rationale. I would say, yeah, I guess I would agree, because Tolstoy isn't trying to be culturally imperialistic, trying to conquer a country culturally. Because you also have within the pacifist tradition some people like Martin Luther King and Gandhi that are trying to have concrete political goals achieved through nonviolent action. And more recently, you have, can't remember his name now, but he works for the Einstein Institute. He was behind the nonviolent work for the Egyptian Revolution.
Is it Gene Sharp? Is that who you're
Yes, Gene Sharp. And Gene Sharp makes a very important point. He said he's not a pacifist, because he says a pacifist is what he is because of religious or moral conviction. He advocates nonviolent resistance because he believes it works, and it plays to the strengths of the weak and allows them to achieve their goals. But I would say that violates the spirit of pacifism, because you're still trying to coerce someone in sort of a backhanded way to get what you want. And so like with Tolstoy, I would say, no, we're not trying to do that. But if everybody did follow this way, there wouldn't be any empire, as the Bolshevik admitted to his Tolstoyan prisoner.
Well, one issue you've raised in some of our past conversations is the relationship between ethics and freedom. So in a nutshell, mm-hmm. what do you see as the relationship between the two?
Let me first define some terms. I would say freedom, the way I would view freedom, is the more traditional ancient medieval view of freedom, that man is free to act and behave as he should or as his faculties direct him to. So there's a goal. In ancient Greek philosophy, there's the idea of telos, which is the idea that man and everything in the universe serve some end, and to the extent that we deviate from that end, we're not free. And so if we come in line with that end that we're supposed to do, then we're free. Now, a more general definition of freedom would be free from the capricious will of tyrants. So for instance, you know, in a free society, you wouldn't get busted with 30 years for having some weed in your trunk of your car. So I'm going to use that definition for now. I think it's one we can more easily agree on. So the idea then is, if you want to have a political society where we don't have these kinds of capricious rules, they don't make any sense, people are thrown in prison, people are killed, you can't have that kind of a system without what we would call the virtues. In the ancient Greek world, there were four virtues: prudence, temperance, courage, and fortitude. So you have courage is not just bravery on the battlefield, but also the courage of your convictions, doing the right thing without fear of even death. Prudence is doing as Aristotle would define prudence as, doing the right thing at the right time for the right reason. All right, there isn't a kind of blanket, pre-built superstructure for ethics you can just apply strictly to every situation before it happens. You have to have a certain base standard already, and then use prudence or reason rightly directed to say, okay, in this case, should I do this or this or this? So, for example, if justice is giving one's due, if you owe someone money, should you give it to them? Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no, at a particular moment. You know, maybe the person is schizophrenic right now and might buy a gun and kill people. You don't give him the money right away. You got to wait. You know, and if he's in his right mind, then yeah, pay the debt. So there's this kind of navigating the situation. Let's see, justice. Justice is, of course, you know, giving one one's due. That's the definition of justice. And so that's the other virtue. And so with these virtues, these are behavioral patterns and attributes that we have as persons that make us better persons and better able to navigate the affairs of life. So the key element here is reason rightly used. And so humans have capacities that we share with the animals. We eat, we sleep, we drink. And we have capacities we don't share with the animals. You know, we're introspective. We can do scientific research. We can write history, write poetry. So to the extent that we actualize by acting them out, our animal appetites, we become less human because we're no longer using or actualizing what makes us distinctly human, our reason. And so it's, you often see with the new atheists, they'll say, well, we're believing in reason, but then they use that to justify gratifying their animal desires. Well, that's a contradiction. You can't say, I'm being reasonable, but then actualizing behaviors that by definition are not reasonable because we share them with the animals. Eating, drinking, sleeping are not rational activities as an act of the mind because animals do that too. It's not a rational action. And so then when we look at reason rightly used towards the goal, the end of what humans should focus for, we can then better able to navigate these situations. And we can also say that man will either govern his own will or something or someone else will govern that will. And so in a free society, everyone is self-policing, right? We have the capacity to murder, rape, steal, but we don't. Some would say we're afraid of punishment, but ideally we should do it because out of love of the good, that it's just wrong. And so because we are so self-controlled, we don't even need police to tell us what to do or to even force it. And so then if you have a community where people lack self-control, they are not using their reason to control their desires, passions, appetites, then somebody else will. Nature abhors a vacuum. So there's a vacuum of order or a vacuum of reason. Something else will fill it. And so if there's lawlessness and chaos, like Somalia or Mexico, something fills in the void, either gangs or drug cartels or Muslim organizations or the state. And, of course, that's why tyrants create these preconditions for the political implosion of a society. There's chaos, there's paranoia. Everybody says, stop the killing, stop the looting. And the tyrant walks in and says, yeah, I'll stop the killing and the looting, but at a price, your freedom.
Well, it sounds like you're really in some ways expounding on the argument of Hobbes. You know, Hobbes, of course, said that what makes civilization possible is the restraint of the individual's passions by the tyrant. He said that, you know, the choice is really just chaos or tyranny. And of course, mm-hmm. you know, given he lived, of course, in the context of the English Civil War, so obviously his exactly. views on that were skewed by that. But it sounds like really you're saying, well, that there is a third way in that self-restraint. It doesn't have to be chaos and it doesn't have to be tyranny, but, you know, if individuals can make the choice to restrain themselves, and if enough individuals do that, we don't really need a police state to control crime and things of that nature.
Yeah. Another point, Aristotle admits this in The Politics. In Book 2 of The Politics, he says that all of man's desires are infinite in extent, but can never be fully gratified because they are infinite, whether it's desire for honor or glory or wealth or power. You can never have enough. And if you continue to feed that, you'll never feed it. So you have to have people that can use their reason to rein in those desires. They say, no, we know we can't meet it to the greatest degree we would like. We'll meet it to the needs that we need to survive. And beyond that, you know, we won't worry too much about that.
Well, what would you say helped you to formulate some of your ideas about these questions? I mean, did you always think this way? Were there experiences? Were there individuals? Were there things that you read that helped shape your thinking?
Yeah, I would say I always had an intuition that morality or virtue was a necessary but not a sufficient condition for freedom. But I didn't have a way to articulate it. I would say the breakthrough came a few years ago when I read two works. Well, actually more than two, but two big works. Libido Dominandi by E. Michael Jones and Revolution from Above by Kerry Bolton, as well as historic works like Etienne Botti's Logic of Voluntary Servitude and Plato's Republic, where they all lay out this foundation based that with humans either control themselves through self-control or other people will control them from the outside. And what we call virtue is just reason controlling our own base appetites and desires. So, for instance, with Etienne Botti, he argues that tyrants create, well, how do they stay in power? They stay in power because they get people to be okay with the tyranny. The people that run the empire, he takes their vices and gratifies them. An example in modern literature would be in Frank Herbert's Dune. In the first book, Baron Vladimir Harkonnen addicts his minions to the spice, which is a very powerful psychedelic drug. And if you don't get it, you'll go into withdrawal. And so he's the only provider of the drug, and he says to his minions, do what I say or you don't get the drug. And then they go into withdrawal if they don't do that. And then the vast masses that are plundered, they're just deluded through games and spectacles and all of these trivialities. We see in Botti mentions the story of Croesus in Sardis, where when Cyrus the Great invades the Lydian kingdom and conquers Lydia, he accepts Croesus as an advisor because of his wisdom, which was known throughout the world. And Sardis revolts when Cyrus is away on campaign. And so Croesus says, after the revolt's been put down, don't kill these people. Don't even put a garrison there. Get them addicted to these petty pleasures. Disarm them. And you won't have to worry about them anymore. The problem will take care of itself. And I think that's probably the earliest written record in history where somebody is giving a cogent argument to the tyrant. How do you maintain control? This is how you do it. And we see with E. Michael Jones, he starts out, he's coming from a Catholic tradition, and he starts with the French Revolution and Marquis de Sade. And Marquis de Sade, who is known for his sexual deviancy and his sadomasochism, argues that, consistent with the classical tradition, that the evil man is at war with his own soul. There's essentially two elements, the rational element and the bestial element, and they're constantly fighting each other. Now, for Marquis de Sade, that's a good thing, because for an ever-expanding empire, you need people that are aggressive, militaristic, and easily directed in other directions. If you're constantly in a state of flux, you're always changing. It's easier for that change to be directed. You don't have to create change, you have to direct change. Whereas the moral man is at peace with himself. The reason governs the appetites. And so they're a lot harder to get to go to war or to support the expansion of the empire. Because it's not a matter of manipulating the change of emotions. You have to create the undersurge, the wellspring, for that change to be grounded on. It's like a plant. You plant it in the soil. If it's bad soil, the plant will die. If it's good soil, the plant will flourish. And so the tyrant needs an individual whose emotional states are constantly in flux. And so you have to have a soil that creates those conditions of flux by manipulating desires and passions and gratifying them. But as Aristotle pointed out, they'll never be satisfied. So you can constantly repackage them in any infinite number of ways to keep people in the state of sort of anger and discontent and angst, but not really knowing what to do with it. So you say, well, he's the problem, or that country is the problem, or that person's the problem, and you just direct those energies in that direction. Whereas the moral person has used his reason to control his desires, and so it's harder then for the tyrant to then take advantage of that latent flux. He has to create it, which means he has to tear down those rational edifices in that person's behavior and lifestyle, and then replace them with non-rational superstructures. And then he can direct him to whatever goal he sees fit. But, you know, that's not easily done. If you have people who are ethical or moral in that sense. And so the goal then is to have people that do not use their reason to control their animal desires, are constantly having their tastes and desires tickled, and constantly keeping them discontented. Because, as Aristotle said, our desires are infinite. They cannot be fully gratified in any material object. And so Augustine, in the autobiography, The Confessions, says that the infinite hole that we're trying to fill can only be filled by God. Now, Aristotle wasn't looking that far ahead, but that infinite hole that we all have as humans, if you have Madison Avenue or the government or tyrants or whatever, they always end up manipulating it. It's manipulating states of emotions or just states that people live in to then have them to be available to do these things. And so it's a combination of reading the classics, Aristotle, Plato, Augustine and Aquinas, Etienne Boti, modern writers like, you know, E. Michael Jones, Kerry Bolton, Ralph Peters, who I heard from reading Kerry Bolton's Revolution from Above, and being a member of U.S. military and policy analyst, what he has to say about how the American military functions and what its goal is, you know, it's very enlightening. Because he says that the goal of American culture is the vanguard of the American military by splitting the culture of our targets, the Chinese, the Russians, the Middle East. They're fighting this fifth column, this cultural fifth column of the home front against American culture. He calls it a plague of pleasure. And so they're already handicapped. They got one hand tied behind their back because they're fighting American culture coming in through the back door. And so in the U.S. military, which embraces that culture, it's not fighting it, it's going with the flow. It's able to take advantage of its own strengths against those of its opponents. And so we see with people like Ralph Peters and Marquis de Sade that the soul of empire, or the essential nature of empire, is this state of flux of the soul, or libido dominandi, which is the lust to dominate. And so by cultivating the lust to dominate in individuals, you can then have the empire. Because Plato says in the Republic that a state is composed of people. So certain kinds of people create certain kinds of states. People that are militaristic create, like, a Sparta. People that are oligarchic create Athens. So the state is a reflection of the people that make it up. And so a tyranny needs to have a population that is populated by petty tyrants. Because once the foundation of the state, coming from the people, and all the people are just like him, he doesn't have very much to fear, because everybody wants to be like him, even if they can't. And he can tap into those desires. So what you can do to keep the masses happy and stultified is bread and circus, like in the Roman Empire, the American welfare system we have here. An example of this would be the immoral individual is no different than a tyrant. The only difference is the power that one has. So somebody who goes online on a shooter game and shoots people up, as opposed to Columbine, well, he's the same kind of person. He's just getting it vented out in a more peaceful, less socially destructive manner. Also, we see with the tyrant, he typically monopolizes things, women, harems. So pornography is just a virtual harem, where everybody can be their own private sultan without actually having to challenge the tyrant's authority. Their own discontent and their own libido dominandi can be channeled into these trivialities. Sports, it's a very libido dominandi-oriented activity. You conquer someone, you beat them into the ground. But the tyrant doesn't have to worry about it. You know, there's going to be a revolt from the Colosseum or the revolt from the football stadium against the government. You know, you're not going to have the keyboard commandos rise up against the government. So he creates these images of himself, and then he finds ways to satisfy those desires of these people beneath him that keep them happy enough so they don't rise up against him. We also see this mentality expressed in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. He says that Julius Caesar, the tyrant, is afraid of Cassius because he reads too much. He thinks, you know, someone like Mark Anthony or the people that compete in the games, he's not afraid of them. They're easily kept happy. Just give them what they want, feed their desires, and they'll be happy. They don't think. They don't really struggle against the system. Whereas Cassius did. He thought. He was a philosopher. And he planned a conspiracy to kill Caesar. Now, ultimately, he was caught up in his own devices and was killed at Philippi he committed suicide, actually. But his army was defeated at Philippi by Caesar's nephew, Octavius, and his lieutenant, Mark Antony.
Well, you've talked about some of the things I've written about over the years, like the concept of totalitarian humanism. I know that's one aspect of my own thinking and writing you've expressed interest in. How would you relate the two?
Yeah, I would say that totalitarian humanism and that tyranny, we see. And this is the point that I want to make. The 1960s and the countercultural revolution was one non-organic and two not actually a counterculture. It was a false culture. So, for instance, we have a hint of this in Kunin's The Strawberry Statement. He was a 60s radical, and he said that he was confronted by the left wing of the Rockefellers. And they were saying, yeah, well, hip and cool with all your stuff about desegregation and, you know, free love and all this stuff. No, they, of course, were for the war in Vietnam, the Rockefellers. But they said, you know, we'll bust you around, we'll give you money, you know, we'll allow you to canvas and do things like that, as long as you help us on our way. And Kunin says, they were doing this to use us as a radical left. So they appear center so that when the Americans are pushed in their direction, they don't appear radical because they have this false radical opposition out here that they funded. Also, there was the undercover work by Jerry Kirk. He infiltrated the SDS, the Communist Party, USA, and he said, these guys are funded by the tax-exempt foundations, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Fords, and they fund these people not because they think they're going to cause a revolution or because they, you know, think they're useful. They think they're useful. And in one of two ways. The first way is what Kunin mentioned, the idea that you create a false left, a false extreme that scares people to give you what you want. And the other thing is they advocate certain social mores, and you have them push that. Like, for instance, the CIA started the drug revolution, as Timothy Leary admits. He was actually working for the CIA testing LSD. And then when they saw that it worked, they sent him out to the community at large and, you know, turn on, tune in, drop out. Which is just like Soma in A Brave New World, where that tyranny is maintained because they get people to live this drugged out existence where they're not thinking, they're not working against the tyranny, they're just taking their drugs. And so totalitarian humanism, where it pushes for things like, you know, feminism and homosexuality and racial equality and all these things, they are the very people that funded these movements back in the 60s. Alfred Kinsey, who did the scientific heavy lifting for the sexual revolution, was funded by the Rockefellers. And in fact, in 1953 and 54, during the Rees Committee, which was an investigation of the non-profit tax-exempt foundations, they actively interfered with the committee to prevent Kinsey's research from being presented in the committee and in the report, because it served their purposes to create these preconditions. And so, again, a lot of these social values that the totalitarian humanists are pushing for, you know, 100 years ago, they were working this out and then beginning to lay the foundations by funding research, you know, paying for political favors to get the laws changed until they get to the point where it's everybody accepts it. And now they're just enforcing the ultimate end game of this move that they started about 100 years ago.
How would you define your own political identity then? I know that we touched on that a little bit. I mean, do you accept any labels for yourself? Are you conservative, liberal, libertarian, any of these things?
It's hard to find a label. I would say I agree with, hold on, what is his name again? There was a term called autarky. Now, normally we think of it as like an autocracy, a single all-powerful dictator. But there was a libertarian pacifist named Robert Lefebvre, and he used the term autarky to mean self-rule, which means I rule myself, which is very much in line with what I believe. I don't necessarily buy into everything that Robert Lefebvre stated, but I certainly think that on a sort of what glues society together, that's a good. As far as economics, you know, any system, I don't really have any favoritism toward one or the other. I tend to sympathize with more community oriented, like communes or cooperatives. Culturally, socially conservative, but that needs to be defined as well, because often conservative means defending the status quo, which is not really conservative. I think Hans Hoppe gives one of the better definitions, the acceptance of a higher order, not just the acceptance of hierarchy, which even the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany accepted, but they weren't conservative, but the acceptance of the higher order of the universe that undergirds and informs the universe and draws us to it. And then also, so there's a lot of things, you know, there's traditional anarchism in the sense of a voluntary social order, not economically favoritistic or anything, socially conservative. So there isn't really a label for that.
Well, much of what you're saying sounds very similar to someone like Dorothy Day.
Exactly.
I think probably your views and hers would jive and fit together quite well. Well, how would you go about approaching something like political activism or political activism mm-hmm. or action? Or do you think that's even worth doing in the first place? For instance, do you believe in things like, say, civil disobedience? Or do you believe in working within the system to change society? Obviously, as a pacifist, you wouldn't believe in armed struggle or something like that. But what do you believe in making efforts to change the wider society or the political system?
I do believe that, let me put it this way, I don't believe in, like, nonviolent resistance like Gandhi and King for the reasons that Gene Sharp pointed out. That's not really a pacifism. I also don't believe in working in the system, because then that would be ends justify the means, and you'd be betraying what you already believe. But, yeah, I would like to see the police state rolled back. I'd like to see tyranny rolled back. And so the way that I would go around doing that is starting at the grassroots level, because real change, lasting change, takes place bottom up. And so what you need is, with back to the political space analogy, with a police state, right, every social institution is the government. In a free society, the government, the political state, the monopoly of violence, is very limited or non-existent within that political space. But on a more fundamental level, there's space within each human individual and their will. Back to Marquis de Sade's distinction between the man at war with his soul and the man who's at peace. And so given that tyranny only survives because there are millions of or thousands of petty tyrants under him, you have to turn each individual person away from their own petty tyrannies to the rational, moral life. And so political action would be a function of education and community organizing, in the sense that you go into people, you know, you help the sick and the needy, you build institutions of education and welfare that are outside the state, that have accountability, you educate people and hold them accountable for what they do. So you say, if you're tired of the police state, you're tired of the oppression, first start with yourself. It's always easy to say, you change, you change, you change. But any real change has to start with you and the people around you. And so if you want to look at, you know, think of the political landscape as a, what were those old toys back in the 90s? You had those light-up things you'd plug into a board to make like a clown or something?
That was a little after my time.
I think they were light brights or something. So, you know, they're all, if the tyranny is like red, they're all red lights. And it's like green would be freedom. You go to each light and flip it green until it's all green. And then the soil, the political space, doesn't allow for the tyrant. And as Botti pointed out, and as we saw in the collapse of the Soviet Union, and as Tolstoy argued, when you cease to collaborate with evil, and enough people cease to collaborate, then it falls apart. As Henry David Thoreau said when he was in prison during the Mexican War, the problem with the Mexican War and slavery wasn't the slaveholders or the professional politicians, but the average person who just put up with it. And they were just happy, or they weren't upset enough to cease collaborating. You know, Thoreau on Civil Disobedience says rather beautifully that people talk about secession as the state, but secede as an individual. You know, don't wait for the state legislature, just secede yourself. And say, I will no longer collaborate with evil. And tell other people to do that. You know, Mises at its best, even he said, never compromise with evil, but advance more boldly against it. Even if he later copped out during World War II, he still had the right idea. And so, by educating people and training people and creating institutions that reward and support rash reason and virtue, then we can create the soil which the tyrant would die. He couldn't grow out of it anymore because the soil that he needs is like a toxic waste dump. And once you clean that up, he can't stay there anymore because he no longer has the nutrients to feed on to stay there. So you have to basically clean out the soil, which is the body politic.
Well, I know that you are also a historian, and you're interested in some revisionist thinkers. Do you want to explore that a little bit?
Yeah. I would say that in the 20th century, I think you'd agree as well, it's all wrong, at least the official story. One of the leading thinkers, let's say like in World War II, you have Pat Buchanan's recent book about Churchill and Hitler and the unnecessary war. You have, 2011, the unpublished magnum opus of Herbert Hoover was published called Freedom Betrayed. And you have George Kennan and many other thinkers that show us that World War II, in particular, in the 20th century in general, didn't happen according to the narrative. For instance, George Kennan, who was in the State Department, he was a major representative to the Soviet Union. He organized the containment policy during the Cold War. He was a big player. He was in the inner clique. And there was a lecture he gave at a university, which was put into a book called American Diplomacy. And in American, and he argues that from 1900 to 1950, American policy was schizophrenic and more crusading in its orientation, trying to attain goals that were not meaningful. There was no meaningful, you know, what does it mean to fight for freedom? You know, what does it mean to, you know, get rid of want or, you know, things like that, or kill fascism? And these are ideas. You don't kill an idea by fighting a war. And so he starts off with the Mexican War. The way that spawned is, well, Spain was, or the Spanish War, I'm sorry. In Cuba, Spain was oppressing the independent revolutionaries, and they were being really mean and nasty. And so the Americans, after the main battleship blew up, which you blamed on the Spanish, but they didn't do, it was a boiler explosion, use that as a pretext to go in to, quote, liberate the Cubans. Of course, what he tells us is in the U.S. diplomatic records, the Spanish ambassador was willing to meet every demand that the United States had set. Spain would give a plebiscite to the Cubans. You know, they would leave if they voted for them to leave. But we never wanted to liberate the Cubans. We wanted the sugar and all that stuff for our companies in the United States. And so that was a nice pretext. And when the Spanish were actually going to do it, we had to strike before it became public, and that we'd lose our chance to hijack the Cuban Revolution. The same in Philippines. And, these early revolutions were not socialist communist either. They were more Catholic populist. Because at the time, communism still hadn't generated that influence yet. The next most important distinction in the 20th century, and it's a distinction that one of your previous interviewees noticed, I think it was your interview with Craig Fitzgerald. He said that he had read Anthony Sutton and his work on Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution and Wall Street and Hitler and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it also was larger three-volume work of the technical transfers from the capitalist West to the Soviet Union. And Sutton says that the communists and the capitalists are not fundamentally at odds. the plutocratic elite funds communism because it's a closed market. Communism, they can't innovate, they can't create an independent center of economic competition. So what they do is they create these communist revolutions by funding them, and then they call in their chips, say, well, nationalize this, 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 and this, because I've paid for your revolution. And then they kind of monopolize the industries. There's always the risk of nationalization. But with, you know, cost-benefit analysis, you know, you can make a profit still. A classic example would be in the Congressional Records, 1921, where they reviewed the Russian Revolution. And they interviewed Raymond Robbins, who worked for William Thompson, who worked for Citibank. And so his goal was to, Robbins's goal was to look, scope out the Soviet Union for the best resources and things like that. And so he could then go back to his handlers in Wall Street and say, you know, this is where you need to set up camp. And Lenin knew that he needed capital to develop the Soviet Union. So what Lenin does is he works within the system. And even the American labor leader, Samuel Gompers, knew that Lenin sold out to the capitalists and wrote about it in his own publications, that he just sold out to Wall Street. And so the whole goal of the Russian Revolution was to create this sort of closed economic system, which would be perpetually at Wall Street's nipple. They could always, when there was the next technological shift, the Russians would have to have it in technology imported because they couldn't make it on their own under the communist system. And another element of that is from Kerry Bolton and E. Michael Jones. They also tacitly admit that, but they also say that capital, the advanced market economies of the plutocrats, these traditional structures, families, the church, volunteer organizations, nationalism, all stand in the way of the free flow of goods. And so revolutionary movements can very quickly eviscerate a society, destroy church, family, voluntary institutions, nationalism. And then when it collapses under its own weight, they can then move in and sell everything off. You think of first Angola during the 70s and 80s, the MPLA, which was the hardcore Soviet-backed group, was also backed by Gulf Oil and the Rockefellers because they were making business deals with the Angolan government for access to oil. There's this one island off the coast of Angola called Cabinda, which was where they got most of their oil from. And so the Rockefellers and Gulf Oil were supporting the MPLA to get access to that oil. At the same time, the United States government was funding UNITA to fight the MPLA. So no matter who won, we would have access to all of those natural resources. But so it does two things. It hollows out the society so there's nothing left. And no matter who wins, we can then walk in and auction everything off. And that's been the strategy for the past century.
Well, a classic
of the plutocratic elite.
Well, a classic illustration of what you're talking about, of these unholy alliances between capitalists and communists that have emerged, is that Armand Hammer. He was an American oil baron.
Yes.
He was actually kind of a family of Marxists.
Yeah.
Who were involved with the Socialist Labor Party, the original De Leonist Party in the United States. And during the early years of the Bolshevik Revolution, he actually got involved in the oil trade with the Soviet Union. And essentially, that's how Occidental Petroleum came into being, is because of this. A bit of trivia that's gone down the memory hole there.
Oh, exactly. And some of that element is drawn out by Anthony Sutton. But really, communism itself, if you look at Marx and Engels, right, Engels had the factory, and Marx was the parasite just getting subsidized by Engels to write as literature. Communism's never changed. It's always the parasite to the plutocrat who's willing to pay for it. The minute the plutocrat stops paying, the communist goes away. You can see in China, Mao Zedong never would have won if the United States and wealthy plutocrats hadn't backed him up. You had the Rockefellers, PRI, Pacific Research Institute, which gave a lot of policy planning to the federal government that Mao Zedong was not a communist. He was an agrarian reformer. Chiang Kai-shek should work with Mao Zedong. We had Dean Acheson, who was behind sending equipment and technical experts to train 10 communist Chinese divisions. We also have the double agent, Harry Dexter White, who sabotaged a gold shipment to the nationalist Chinese, which would have prevented hyperinflation. And then, of course, we have Marshall's order to Chiang Kai-shek in the middle of 1946 to stop pursuit of the communists, which allowed them to rebuild and recoalesce and then drive the nationalists out of China. And this whole time, they're giving them money, training them equipment, and hamstringing the nationalists. They'll sell them weapons, but then won't deliver the weapons. Or if they deliver the weapons, they're broken without ammunition. They did the same thing to the whites in the Russian Civil War. They would sell them weapons and not give it to them. Or if they did, they were broken.
Well, one thing that's interesting about Russian history is that when communism in the Soviet Union actually fell apart, it didn't take much effort for the old communist elite to essentially reinvent themselves as a new capitalist elite. That happened almost overnight. And ironically, the actual life expectancy in Russia after the fall of communism actually went down. A lot of people don't know that, but the turned out that the gangster capitalism that came afterward during the Yeltsin years was actually worse for the people than the old Soviet system had been.
Yeah, it's when the 90s, with the collapse of the communist governments, the same thing happened everywhere. Vietnam, when they became privatized, quote-unquote, massive corruption. You know, the communist elite became the new robber barons. In China with Deng Xiaoping. But, you know, that's the system. The communists are already joined to the hip with the plutocrats because they need their money. They don't have any money.
Well, let me ask this question, shifting gears a little bit. You've talked a little bit about the ethic, which you regard as the ethical foundations for free society and some of the cultural foundations. But do you think that these are ideas that are capable of existing across cultural barriers? For example, you know, must a society to function in the way you're describing be a Christian culture? Could it possibly be a culture that was a Hindu culture or an Islamic culture or Jewish culture or, say, something that's similar to the pre-Christian society that we saw in classical Greece or something of that nature?
I would say yes and no. For an example, Thomas Aquinas in the Summa Theologia says that there's the four cardinal virtues and then the three spiritual virtues of faith, hope, and charity. If you were to master the four cardinal virtues, you would have a certain level of beatitude or fulfillment. It would be real, but it would be deficient because it lacked the theological virtues. And so, in the same sense, a non-Christian society, to the extent that it accepts the moral law, and most societies did, you know, very few societies institutionalized murder and theft, at least not within their own communities. Maybe the out-group, but within their own communities, you know, you tell the truth, you don't lie, you don't steal, you don't murder. But they would have a simulacrum, if you will, of that pure freedom. Because freedom is a scale of more or less. They could be more free than today if they adopted you know, an Islamic ethic or a Jewish ethic, but would they have maximal freedom? I don't think they could have maximal freedom unless they were a Christian. And again, in the very narrow sense of free from the capricious rule of men. Because, first, I don't think any other religion has set such a high standard for itself. Because none of the other religions claim that their greatest prophet was God. And so, with Christianity, we do. And with that, we have God as our standard, rather than just some other human prophet or human person. And many of the values in the West that we take for granted, hospitals, universities, charities, freedom of conscience, all of these were built in the Christian West. They didn't really exist in the way we're familiar with in the ancient world, in India or China or Mexico, you know, pre-Columbian Mexico. And so I would say it's in a compendium or degrees by degrees. So could pagans like Aristotle have a certain measure of freedom? Yeah. But it wouldn't be maximal or maximum freedom within the society.
Well, what do you see as being the future of Christianity or of religious belief or spiritual practice in any sense in American culture or in the Western culture? Because most demographic trends and certainly opinion polls and sociological research and that kind of stuff shows that certainly in the European societies now, Christianity is probably at an all-time low in terms of popularity and participation. I saw a while back where something like only 5% of English people, for example, attend church regularly. And I've heard some people on the far right from England lament that if you go into a church of England, most of the people you see there are third world immigrants. Mm-hmm. And also in the United States, which is a much more religious society than many of the European countries, at least at present. In the United States, I've seen polls that show that the points of view concerning religion that would, I guess, collectively be called the non-believer point of views, atheism, agnosticism, something like that, all of those ideas collectively are actually the fastest growing religious perspective, to where it's, you know, currently about 20% of the U.S. population, which is rather astounding considering it would have been much, much less than that just a few decades ago. So what do you see as the future of religious belief or spiritual practice of Christianity, per se, in our own society?
Well, I would say in the Western society, well, in all societies, demographics is destiny. That is, the people that have the most children and can keep them within that mindset that they were raised in win. We see this in history with the fall of the Roman Empire. They were having fewer and fewer children. The German barbarians, the Christians, and then later the Muslims had very high birth rates. There was high mortality rates as well, but the Romans weren't even having kids. And so these people that had more children eventually just overwhelmed the Romans in a kind of war of attrition. And so we see in Europe with the Muslim immigration, I think the average child per Muslim woman is 7 children per woman on average, and the European average is 1.5. It's only a matter of time if that trend stays the same that Europe becomes Muslim. And the Muslims are not flipping to the secular liberal left. They're staying Muslim, unlike a lot of Christians in the United States and England. So in that case, Europe's in trouble because the Muslims are not going to put up with the, you know, hippy-dippy liberal system that they have. And in the United States, we see that the people, I think, with the lowest birth rates in the world are secular Jews, like 1.2 children per couple. And so atheism has no future because it's demographically a dead end. And there are Darwinist thinkers that study demographic trends and birth trends, they say there is no historical example of a secular humanist society continuing more than 100 years because they ran out of kids. Now, you could rob the cradle, so to speak, but it's you're playing the Dutch boy, poking holes in the dikes. You're still not going to turn it around. Because if you're too successful, you'll kill the cradle, and then they won't have kids either. And so in the end, demographically, especially we see in Europe with the Muslims, and even North America, a lot of immigrants from Mexico are Catholic. A lot of foreign immigrants from like Africa and South America, Catholic, Anglican. And like you said, the English churches, they're mostly filled with black people from like the Caribbean or Nigeria or South Africa. And so on a purely demographic level, if you telescope it out 50 to 100 years, secularism, I don't think will exist in any appreciable form because demographically it has no staying power and it has to rob the cradle to survive. But if it becomes too successful, it kills the cradle and it still dies. It's just, you're just playing Dutch boy. And this research is borne out by Eric Kaufman, Shall the Religious Inherit the Earth? He's a secular humanist and is afraid by this trend. Then The Empty Cradle by Philip Longman. He also reaches similar conclusions. And within the demographic, I think there was a Darwinian podcast, something called like This Life Darwin or something. And they had some demographers talking about that as well, that it's game over demographically for the secular humanist liberal societies. They can't extend out in time for any great distance.
So you feel then that European civilization will essentially become Islamic at some point in the future. There will, the prophets who say that Arabia will emerge out of that, a sort of European Arabic or European Muslim hybrid. You would agree with that conclusion?
I would say if the trends remain unchanged. I mean, possible changes could be the Europeans wake up and kick the Muslims out. That'd be kind of a bloody civil war, and I'm not sure they could actually pull that off. But that's a possibility. Europe, you know, might not go Christian, but they might pick some religion that encourages them to have children again and create kind of a nuclear resistance on the basic family level. But they'd still be a long shot. So, yeah, if the trends don't change, you know, the Muslims don't get killed in a Holocaust, it's probably something like that's going to happen.
Well, what about the future of American civilization? What do you see as the demographic future of that or the cultural future of that?
I would say within the conservative, with also Longman and Kaufman mentioned that there are religious minorities that don't have a lot of turnover. The Amish and the Mennonites and the Hutterites, they have a high retention of their youth. And other groups, Hasidic Jews and strict Muslim communities. I would say in the United States, some blend of Latin American Catholicism, maybe in the Southwest and the South, and then, you know, some remnant of a resurgent Christian Protestantism of whatever shape, Calvinist, Baptist, whatever. This is, you know, many years in the future, but I think some sort of Christian-Protestant divide, with the Catholics being a bit stronger than they were last time in the 1850s when they were just a few Irish immigrants.
What about the future of Mormonism in the United States? I've heard some people say that they are somewhat unique in that they do tend to have not only a fairly, if not insulated, a fairly cohesive subculture, and one that is procreative in nature. They tend to have a fairly high number of children. What do you see them growing considerably beyond their numbers at present, and perhaps becoming a much more influential social force?
Yeah, Mormonism is one of the fastest growing world religions because it's based on endogamous growth, you know, growth from marriage and procreation, and conversion. So it's growing at both methods of growth. It's the fastest growing, I think, religion in the world. But the only problem I see with Mormonism is that it's kind of like split. You have the more liberal, friendly Mormons, you know, we don't believe in polygamy. We don't believe that blacks were cursed for siding with Satan during the Great Revolt, you know, before the earth was created. Then you have the hardline Mormons who say, you know, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, and it's all the way, polygamy, blood atonement, and all that stuff. You know, I just wonder, though, you know, the people that are the nice, friendly Mormons that we look at, they're not really Mormons. They don't believe what Joseph Smith or Brigham Young said. Maybe they'll realize that and say, okay, let's go hardcore. But I do think that's a potential hiccup, this sort of division between the hardliners that are more authentically Mormon. But generally speaking, the Mormons are, I think, the single wealthiest institution in the United States. I mean, they own Marriott. They're very well set up financially and politically. They had Mitt Romney 2012. So they are very well positioned to take advantage of any situation.
What about other kinds of spiritual or religious movements? I was discussing this with someone else a while back who was saying that he thought that as civic institutions break down in the United States, and for mm-hmm. example, due to fiscal constraints and fiscal bankruptcy, mm-hmm. the state is unable to deliver social services and public assistance and that kind of stuff and on the level we've been accustomed to, that mm-hmm. he thought that there might well be a revival of religious institutions that provide some kind of community and are able to fill in that void. And he was speculating, well, there could, you know, it could take on any number of forms. It could be some more quote unquote traditional form of religion. Mm-hmm. But it could also be other things that are, you know, somewhat unusual by what we're compared to what we're used to, you know, groups like the Scientologists or whatever. Do you see, there being a proliferation of, cause I know that it is the case that during a time of social upheaval or social breakdown, all sorts of somewhat exotic religious movements do tend to develop. Mm-hmm. You had a lot of things like that in the 19th century, you know, right alongside the utopian socialist colonies and so forth. In the 1960s, you had these spiritualistic gurus and, you know, the hippie communes with the self-styled guru as their leader and that kind of mm-hmm. thing. Do you see stuff like that propping up again?
I think those things crop up when there's a tremendous state of flux, but they don't have a lot of staying power. You know, the great religions that have been here for thousands of years, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, about 1,000 years, they have staying power. And so in the long haul, you know, we haven't seen a brand new religion take over since Islam 1,400 years ago. In any meaningful sense, all the other religions are much older than that. The new ones, they're very local. They haven't made much of an impact on things. So I think in the very, very big view, you know, there could always be a new charismatic prophet, but, you know, the last one was Muhammad 1,400 years ago. So I don't see that as terribly likely that they would have staying power. I mean, even the whole hippie guru thing from the 60s is a little passé now.
Well, when you look at our society at large, you know, what do you see as being the most serious problem or the most serious set of problems in our society? You know, I have different types of guests on these programs who and other projects that I do who have, you know, widely divergent ideological views, and you know, there are some people who say immigration is the most serious problem. There are some people who say the economy, foreign policy, you know, and police repression, any number mm-hmm. of things. How would you answer a question like that?
Well, Solzhenitsyn once wrote that when he's asking what happened in Russia, why did we have the revolution, why did we have the gulags, said that there was this peasant woman that told him that man forgot God. And Dostoevsky said, yes, that's what happened. Because in the Bolshevik regime, nobody was accountable to anybody. And so men would become their own gods. So in the broadest possible sense, I would take the position that Dostoevsky pointed out was the biggest problem in Russia. Now, as far as more of a breakdown, rampant materialism, you know, people are, they just want to get more stuff, more money, more stuff, just everything, you know, keep up with the Joneses. Competition, you know, win at any cost, you know, cheat, lie, use steroids, even when you're not supposed to, you know, just win at any cost. And if you get busted, well, you get busted. But, you know, we're not mad at them when they get busted because they were cheating. We're mad because they were caught. You know, it's like in Sparta, if you steal and you get caught, you're punished for getting caught, not for stealing. So, certainly, you know, materialism and this sort of like violent, corrupting competition. The general decline in education. You know, traditionally in the West, you know, from the ancient Greeks up until the 19th century, you know, the foundation of education was the trivium, which was rhetoric, logic, and grammar, which taught you how to speak, how to think, and how to write. For instance, during the Lincoln-Douglas debates in the 1850s, the average listener, you know, maybe had a high school education. You know, he wasn't that farmer type, you know. He would, when they were listening, and Lincoln and Douglas would make their arguments, if Lincoln or Douglas were to say, they'd say, oh, well, no, that's a fallacy. Don't say that, you know, or get back on track. Nobody today would keep political interlocutors on task. They'd just listen and say, oh, whatever. But they can't think. And again, that's part of the process of the consistent de-education of society. For that, you'd want to see people like John Taylor Gatto and Charlotte Iserby, who've documented that thoroughly, how that's proceeded. Also, the general moral life of the country, not properly using their reason to control their appetites. You know, food, sex, drink, drugs, you know, all of those things are, by not actualizing their reason properly to control these desires, they leave themselves vulnerable to be to have those desires manipulated by Madison Avenue or petty or the tyrants in government to keep them distracted, a kind of divide and conquer mentality. So those are more specific under the general umbrella that man forgot God.
Okay, well, on that note, I think we're about out of time. We've been talking for about 90 minutes here. I could certainly have you back on at some point in the future to talk about some of these ideas some more. Is there anything, any parting shot you'd like to leave us with?
No, I think I've spoken my piece for the moment.
Okay, well, we really appreciate you being here, Todd. It's been a great program, and I do thank you for your past contributions to Attack the System, and I look forward to hearing more from you in the future. And with that in mind, this is Keith Preston for AttackTheSystem.com. Be sure to follow our website. We update that regularly with new podcasts and new ideas. I also have a couple of books out, and you can check those out on the homepage of AttackTheSystem.com. There's an anthology out of some of my past writings. There's also my book on the Civil War in El Salvador in the 80s. Also, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. One of our co-editors, Vince Reinhart, does a very good job managing our Facebook page and our Twitter account. And often there's actually a lot more interesting information on Facebook and Twitter from us than there is on the website, because it flows much more rapidly. It's updated much more regularly. But until then, this is Keith Preston for Attack the System, and have a good evening.